We good to go? Okay. Oh, there might be more coming in.
Yeah. Our next case is State versus Carlson. Council may approach. Is appellant ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Thank you. Your Honor's counsel, and may it please the court, thank you, students, faculty, staff, for being here observing our judicial system in action, and for making my first appearance in front of this court significantly more nerve-wracking than I had initially anticipated. Your efforts in that regard are not going unnoticed, so thank you. My name is Cole Burmeister. I'm from the Sarpy County Public Defender's Office, and I represent the appellant, David Carlson, in this matter. We asserted three errors in our brief, the trial court's overruling of our motion to suppress admission of evidence of exhibits 2, 3, 4, and 5, over objection, and ultimately the sufficiency of the evidence. I plan to spend most of my time today talking about the sufficiency of the evidence. Before I get kind of the meat of my allegations of error, though, I'll touch kind of briefly on the facts. September 11th, 2020, at about 11 p.m., Bellevue police were dispatched to a Baker's in Bellevue, Sarpy County, Nebraska, for a male who was believed to be intoxicated. The reporting party gave identifying information for that individual, as well as the vehicle that they observed him get into, and then waited for law enforcement to arrive on scene. Officer Melrose of the Bellevue Police Department was the first to arrive on scene and approach that vehicle. Mr. Carlson opened the door, and Officer Melrose immediately smelled the odor of alcohol and began a DUI investigation. Mr. Carlson was identified as the individual from the store that the reporting party identified, as well as the sole occupant of the vehicle. His keys were located on the ground outside of the vehicle. He told officers he was not driving because he didn't believe he was able to at that period of time. And he told officers also that he did not drive to that location, but ultimately was dropped off. Ultimately, he was arrested on suspicion of DUI, transported to Sarpy County Jail for testing, where he blew a .112 and was booked among later dismissed charges on that DUI.
And it was his vehicle, right?
That's correct, Joe.
And his statement that he had not driven to that location, my understanding is he credited his transportation to a man named Joe?
That's correct.
A man who he could not give a last name or a phone number to?
That's correct, Your Honor, yes.
From a payphone that did not exist?
That the officer did not see.
That the officer did not see?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Now, again, I'm going to focus mostly on the weight of the evidence. I do believe of my allegations that is the most important, and it really boils down to one thing, in my opinion, and that is, how can someone be in the actual physical control of a motor vehicle where the keys to that vehicle are neither in that person's actual physical possession, nor are they inside of that vehicle?
Before you embark on that, the county court, so to be convicted of DUI, your client either had to be operating a motor vehicle or be in actual physical control, right?
Yes.
The county court did not make a determination which of those two elements your client, it fit for your client, right?
Correct.
What about the district court?
I don't recall specifically the district court order, but I don't believe the district court found either of those as well. I think they just affirmed the county court orders.
So if the district court would have found that there was circumstantial evidence to support that your client had driven intoxicated to that supermarket, would that be sufficient?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think if the district court wanted a specific finding, they should have remanded the cause to the county court to make that finding as the trier of fact.
Did they need to do that, though, when the information was pled either or?
Did the county court need to do that?
Well, would the district court needed to remand to the county court? I mean, the county court found the evidence was sufficient, didn't say on what basis.
Correct.
The district court said circumstantial evidence to support that he had operated a motor vehicle intoxicated.
Understood, Your Honor. So did the district court need to remand when it's the initial complaint pled either or? I guess on that regard, Your Honor, no. I suppose if the district court found that ruling to be sufficient, they could have found it sufficient any number of ways, including the way that the court has indicated. So if the district court made that ruling, I guess I'll retract my statement and say that would be sufficient for the district court to make that ruling.
And would you disagree that the circumstantial evidence would support a finding that your client did drive to that location intoxicated?
Yes, Your Honor, I would. And I can dive into that a little bit specifically. There is no evidence in the record to refute the statement made by Mr. Carlson. The only allegation essentially is that it's not a credible story. The trial court is the one that ultimately makes the finding as to credibility. Without a specific finding on that specific issue, I don't think we can ultimately reach that at an appellate level.
Can we infer it?
I'm sorry?
Can we infer that the court found his testimony not credible?
Under the circumstances, I believe so. Yes, I would say. However, it's testimony of the officer, Mr. Carlson.
His statement, I should say, not testimony.
Yes. I believe that this court or any appellate court could infer that from the record, yes. However, the record on the trial court's finding is relatively thin. It's just basically the one paragraph pronouncement of verdict.
And I take it the store employee did not see Mr. Carlson exit his vehicle to come into the store.
Correct. There is no evidence really to support any allegation that he drove there other than not believing his story that he didn't.
But when the officer arrived, Mr. Carlson was in the driver's seat.
Correct. After having been in the store and exited. Yes.
You make a point about the keys being on the ground outside the car. If they had been on the front driver's floor, would that have made any difference?
I would say yes, Your Honor. If they're inside the vehicle, obviously there's the whole line of case law about being presumed to be in possession of the contents of the vehicle. If you're in there, I think that would kind of fall approximately in there. If they're inside the vehicle and they're within your reach, I think you're probably in possession of them to where you could be found in actual physical control of the vehicle.
Were they within his reach when they were on the ground? Did he just have to open the door and reach down and grab them?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And that's actually an interesting point. Officer Melrose testified that he picked them from the ground and placed them on the roof for the sole purpose of removing them from his realm of control. It's actually easier to reach them from the roof, or to the roof from the inside of the car than the ground outside. So if we believe Officer Melrose's testimony and line of thought on that, all you have to do is roll your window down, reach your arm up, grab the keys, pull them inside. Whereas if they're on the ground outside, you can't do that. You have to fully open the door. You probably can't be buckled. You probably do have to get out of the car to pick them up off the ground and then get back inside of the car. So if we're going, again, if we believe Officer Melrose's line of thought on that, if the keys on the roof are outside of the defendant's realm of control, the keys on the ground have to be as well. Additionally, Your Honor, I've got about 45 seconds left before I go into 2 minutes towards rebuttal time. I'm going to close here with kind of a public policy argument. I know generally this court and the Supreme Court's thoughts on public policy arguments in this arena, but if you'll entertain me just briefly. Mr. Carlson told officers that he was not driving because he believed he couldn't at that time. He obviously exited the store, waited a period of time, and then officers arrived. I think this is the kind of behavior, the self-acknowledgement of your condition that we should encourage. If somebody recognizes they're too intoxicated to operate a motor vehicle, they should not operate a motor vehicle. And if they need shelter of some kind, I mean, he's in a parking lot at 11 o'clock at night. Really, the only place to do that is your vehicle.
Isn't that a job for our legislature and not for our courts?
I would agree, Judge. I know this court's kind of opinion on that argument in this forum, and I understand that. However, I would just close with that, and if I may reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
You may. Thank you.
Thank you.
Morning, counsel.
Your honors. May it please the court, Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appalachian State of Nebraska. Carlson raises three claims on appeal.
Mr. Liss, can you raise the microphone up a little just so everyone can hear? Thank you.
Yep. Is that better?
Much.
Okay. Carlson raises three claims on appeal. I'll briefly address all three claims if time permits. I was not planning to spend much time, if any, on the sufficiency of the evidence, but given that my colleague focused entirely on it and the court did have some questions, I will start there as well. As far as the sufficiency of the evidence, we maintain that the evidence was sufficient for any rational trier of fact to find Mr. Carlson guilty of DUI. He was charged with operating or with being in actual physical control of the motor vehicle while under the influence. When the evidence adduced at trial is viewed in the light most favorable to the state, as our standard of review requires, we maintain that any rational trier of fact could have found him guilty under either theory.
Was there questioning or an issue at trial with regard to the timing? I understand Mr. Carlson told the officer that he left the casino or had his last drink at the casino around 9 p.m., and law enforcement was called and arrived around 11 p.m. So was that evidence developed at trial, or an argument that that delay in time would have gone to whether circumstantial evidence supported that he was operating a motor vehicle under the influence?
I don't recall to what extent that would have been developed as a strategy or to the extent that came out at trial as a theory of defense. But I would say that, the Nebraska Supreme Court's recent decision in State v. Bowl is instructive on the fact that the precise timeline is required in DUI cases. That's certainly a close enough timeline with respect to when he admitted to having the drinks, when he's detained and ultimately arrested, and then when he takes his test. And of course, the test, given his blood alcohol concentration or his breath alcohol concentration, shows that he's clearly under influence well beyond the statutory limit. And the most reasonable inference, of course, is that his alcohol concentration is going down after a period of time as well when he's tested. So to the extent there would have been any dispute, I don't recall exactly how or how much that was disputed. But
so what circumstantial evidence supports the inference that he drove himself from the casino to the Quick Stop or the store?
Well, it's his vehicle. He's alone. He has the keys. He's seen by himself in the store. When the officer gets there, he's by himself in his vehicle. The vehicle and the plate match the description of what the employees had provided who followed him out to his vehicle. He admitted he'd been drinking and was waiting till he was sober enough to drive, to leave. His story about having a guy named Joe bring him and his vehicle there and drop them off and leave isn't all that credible. Claims to have really known nothing about this individual named Joe, and when the officer asked how he contacts Joe, he said, well, from the payphone here, and the officer said to his knowledge there was no payphone there, and the rationale just doesn't really make sense that he would have contacted Joe through a payphone at the store, and Joe would have came there to get him in his vehicle and then brought him back to the store. I mean, the entire story doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So there's ample evidence for any rational trier of fact to conclude that he himself drove to the store.
So we didn't get to it in appellant's argument yet, but with regard to the motion to suppress the evidence, when the officer first made contact with Mr. Carlson in his car, what level of contact is that? Is that a tier one? Is that a tier two where reasonable suspicion is required? And if the initial part is tier one, then when did reasonable suspicion come into play?
Right, and I'm not sidestepping your question. First and foremost, we would maintain that it was waived given that the motion to suppress was not renewed at trial. But for the sake of having a discussion or in the event this court gets to the merits, to answer your question, we would submit that the initial contact was clearly a tier one voluntary encounter. When we look at the facts here, they're pretty close. They almost mirror State v. Gilliam, except in State v. Gilliam, the officer there was actually parked behind the defendant's vehicle and had his overhead lights activated. Here, we don't have that. The officer parks a few stalls down, does not have his overhead lights on, and walks up to the vehicle and makes contact with him. So, I mean, if Gilliam is a tier one encounter, which it was, this clearly is as well. To the extent it became a detention, at one point, did we have reasonable suspicion? I didn't lay that out as meticulously as I would typically in a brief, given that in our assessment, the motion to suppress was clearly waived. But I would say that it probably became a detention when Mr. Carlson started to express an unwillingness or an uncooperativeness with the officers as they were trying to conduct their DUI investigation. I don't have the exact minute of when that, you know, happened, but I know that he was initially answering questions voluntarily, and then eventually as they, you know, proceeded with the DUI investigation, he eventually became, I think the words were, combative, and they ultimately did not do field sobriety tests, partially because of his medical condition and partially because he was unwilling to do so. So I think once you hit that point where he's clearly no longer willing to cooperate with the investigation and the officer's questioning, we have a detention at that point. He's not free to leave. His, you know, his liberty is being restrained, you know, all the classic telltale signs of what would amount to a detention are probably present at that point. And do we have reasonable suspicion at that time? Well, I would submit undoubtedly based on all the information that we've just discussed. I'm not going to rehash it, but given all of that information taken in its totality, we would submit that it clearly was reasonable suspicion for the officers to be conducting a DUI investigation at that point. He smelled of alcohol. He admitted he'd been drinking. You know, they had reason to believe he'd been driving. He said he was waiting until he was sober enough to leave. There was more than enough there for the officers to believe he was or may be under the influence of alcohol.
And if I'm correct, it was Officer Melrose who made the initial in contact with the defendant, correct?
Correct.
And then it was really Officer Jezik who did the DUI investigation. At least that's what it seemed like from the record. Would you agree with that?
That's my understanding.
Yes. And as to your issue on waiver, the motion to suppress, only Officer Melrose testified, correct, at that suppression hearing?
At the suppression hearing, I believe that's correct.
Okay. And when Officer Melrose began testifying at trial, that motion was renewed, correct?
During Melrose's testimony, correct.
Right. So as to Officer Melrose and that initial encounter with them, would you agree that part is preserved?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, as far as the initial encounter, like any observations made by Melrose, I mean, as I understand the motion to suppress, it was aimed primarily at seeking to exclude, you know, the test result and most of that evidence and most of that information. You know, I mean, I suppose there could be some theory that we're going to go further back and say, well, okay, the initial seizure was unlawful and then everything else can't come in after that. But for the sake of argument, even if there was something to that, all you would be excluding is just the absolute initial observations, because even Jezik came pretty quickly after Melrose. So you're getting all of Jezik's testimony about him arriving, I believe, just moments after or just minutes after Melrose. So you're getting all that. You know, you're getting his cruiser camera video from Jezik, for which there was no objection. You're getting the actual data master test result. You're getting virtually everything. So even to the extent that could hold some water, I think it's just a very, very minute piece of the picture here that it wouldn't significantly preserve what they sought to preserve and suppress. So we would maintain the waiver.
Appellant argues that the keys being on the ground makes this different than other DUI cases. How do you respond to that?
I don't think it makes it any different. First and foremost, there was sufficient evidence for any rational trier of fact to conclude that he drove there. So under that theory, we don't even have to talk about the keys. We don't have to talk about actual physical control, any of that analysis. If that's what the finder of fact found, which the evidence supported that finding, he's done. It doesn't even matter. But to the extent we would have that discussion in the context of actual physical control, I don't think the fact that the keys are outside the vehicle would refute him being in actual physical control. When we look at prior cases and we look at the standard, you know, it's that, you know, somebody had the ability to influence or have dominion or control over the vehicle. That's actual physical control. There are a number of factors we can look at as our case law establishes. You know, were they alone in the vehicle? Where was the vehicle? Were the keys in it, or were they in the ignition? But ultimately, what we're looking at and what actual physical control requires is just that you had the ability to easily and immediately control and operate that vehicle. The fact that the keys are right outside the door don't refute or negate the fact that that existed. All they had to do was simply open the door and grab the keys. He probably threw them out when he saw the officer pulling out.
And did Mr. Carlson show the officer where the keys were on the ground? So he knew where they were.
I don't know if he showed him or if I know the officer asked where the keys. He said, well, they're on the ground by your feet. The officer went down there right there. Yeah. I'm out of time. I won't address the admission of exhibits 2 through 5 unless this court has questions. But
do you have any questions?
Okay. If the court has no further questions, we would ask that you affirm the judgment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. How much time does appellant have for rebuttal?
1 minute 39 seconds, Your Honor.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. We talked a lot about kind of the circumstantial evidence supporting the idea that Mr. Carlson drove there. The thing that we've not discussed at this point is there's no indication of his level of intoxication at that time. If the report is that Mr. Carlson left the casino at 9 o'clock, arrived there at 11, we have no indication of if he's intoxicated at that time other than his admission that he had his last drink at 9 o'clock and whether he arrived there at that time. The issue that we run into, and colloquially we just say, are you coming up or are you coming down? So if he had his last drink at 9 o'clock and he's at a .07, it's not illegal for him to drive. Maybe a bad idea, but it's not illegal for him to drive. And if he's, you know, where he is in that kind of situation is a relevant factor that we have no evidence of.
I was going to say, there was no evidence from the defense either as to whether the intoxication level would be going up or down.
Correct. So there's none, again, other than his admission that he had his last drink at 9 o'clock and then got a ride to that location. There's no evidence to support any level of intoxication at that period of time.
And there's no evidence he sat for those 2 hours and drank.
Correct. There's no evidence of what he did in that period of time, which he very well may have done.
Well, didn't he testify he had not had anything to drink after that, after the 9 o'clock?
That would be my recollection. So again, if we're talking about what the court could believe or think based on that period of time, all of these things are in there as well. I just wanted to talk about that a little bit.
I want to ask you just one quick question following up on Judge Moore's on the encounter tier, what tier
yes.
level. When Officer Melrose first approaches the vehicle, what tier would you put that at?
Judge, I'd put that at a detention, sorry. I'm immediately suspect of police-initiated voluntary contacts. I know there's case law on that issue. I just don't think that you can have a police-initiated voluntary contact, barring very specific circumstances. So I would immediately put that at a detention, Judge.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank
you. And Mr. Baumeister, for what it's worth, my first oral argument was before the Supreme Court at the University Creighton School of Law, so it could be worse.
You did have it a little worse. Thank you.
Thank you both for being here. We'll take the case under advisement, and you are excused. And with that, we are going to adjourn at least the oral argument part of this morning. So you've heard the two cases.